Welcome to the Swan Signal Podcast, a production of Swan Bitcoin, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin using automatic recurring buys at swanbitcoin.com. I'm Brady, head of education at Swan. Every week, we invite two Bitcoiners to join us for a discussion hosted by myself and variously joined by Swan founder Corey Clipston, co-founder Jan Pritzker, and creative director Jason Don, aka Brecky von Bitcoin. It's a unique format in the Bitcoin content space to pair up Bitcoiners who have never or are rarely seen or heard from together. It makes for some great discussions. We broadcast these live, and then we publish the audio here on this feed. This week, we are joined by Knut Svanholm, author of Sovereignty Through Mathematics and the new Independence Reimagined, and Gigi, author of 21 Lessons, What I've Learned from Falling Down the Bitcoin Rabbit Hole, and creator of projects like bitcoin-resources.com and bitcoin-quotes.com. Be sure to follow at Swan Bitcoin on Twitter so you can tune in live whenever you can. We also broadcast on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch. But if you can't do it live, you'll always be able to catch the Swan Signal Live conversations recorded here on this podcast. I'm glad you found your way here. Hope you enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of Swan Signal Live. I'm your host, Brady Swenson. I'm going to take just a second to shill Swan here at the top because I often neglect to do that. And I'll give our guests a second to tweet out the live stream. You guys will find it at the top of the Swan Bitcoin Twitter account, at Swan Bitcoin. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin. It's the best way to buy Bitcoin. We automatically withdraw dirty fiat from your bank account. We then automatically turn that fiat into Bitcoin, and you can set up automatic withdrawals as well straight to your Bitcoin wallet. It's the whole process, set it and forget it. It's a pretty magical experience, actually. We also have the lowest fees for auto stacking in the United States. You can get as low as 0.99%, 66 to 75% lower than Coinbase, and 36 to 57% lower than Cash App, depending on how much you're stacking. And of course, we are forever Bitcoin only. No distractions from altcoins, payments, coupons, laser focused on being the best auto stacking service out there. You can get started today at swanbitcoin.com/halving to celebrate the recent halving down to 6.25 Bitcoin per block reward and get $10 worth of sats dropped into your account. All right. We are here today with two of my personal favorite Bitcoiners, authors of three fantastic Bitcoin books. We've got 21 Lessons right here by Dordigi. Sits on my nightstand, permanent place. I've got Knut's books on Kindle. Don't have them in hard copy yet, but definitely need to do that. So I would like to welcome...
There they are.
So welcome to you, Knut. Welcome to you, Gigi. Thanks for joining us today, guys.
Hey,
thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. We're also joined today by creative director at Swan, Brecky von Bitcoin. What's up, Brecky?
Hey, everybody. Good morning.
All right. I love that mask, man. That is some pretty stellar stuff there.
I mean, I got to protect my OPSEC, you know.
By the way, I think we need something else than morning and evening and everything else, because, you know, in Bitcoin time, it's kind of meaningless because it's evening for me, you know.
Yeah.
So what do we do? Like, good block to you, sir.
Yeah, good block to you, sir. That would be amazing.
Let's make that happen. Top of the block to you, sir.
Top of the block.
All right, awesome. So we have a lot to talk about. You know, Knut dropped a new book. It's called Reimagining Independence. Reimagining, is that right? Reimagining Independence.
Independence Reimagined.
Independence Reimagined. Yeah, there we go. Independence Reimagined. And this is a follow-up to Sovereignty Through Mathematics, which really got into more of the kind of how Bitcoin works. And this is more of a study on the kind of political and economic outcomes of Bitcoin, and comparing, you know, a Bitcoin world, an imagined Bitcoin world, to the kind of the situation that our current status quo, you know, way that our societies are organized. So Knut, let's start off with you, man, and kind of just, you know, have this conversation sort of based around your book as an outline, because there's so many good ideas that we can all dive into and weigh in on. Do you want to give us a quick kind of summary of the ideas in the book, and then maybe let's start with toward the front of the book where we talk about the difference between involuntary and voluntary cooperation?
Yeah, sure. A few words about the book first. It's sort of a joint effort. I got some help from the Space Cat, actually. He wrote the foreword, Hodlonaut, and the cover is a picture of the full Bitcoin full node statue by Fractal Encrypt, if you've seen that. This was sold at an art show in Miami for one whole Bitcoin a couple of months back. And back on the backside here, I have a little meme made by a guy called Swede Toshi. I think you've all had your faces.
Well, we know Swede Toshi.
Yeah, you know that guy, right?
Shout out Swede Toshi.
Daniel Prince helped me with it a bit too, and of course Guy Swan, who just sent me a sound clip yesterday of him reading the very last sentence from the book. So I guess that means that the audiobook is not too far away now. So an audiobook is coming really soon, hopefully, if everything works out with Audible and Bitcoin Audible, which is Guy Swan's new name for his awesome pod where he reads Bitcoin content.
I think Guy just doesn't sleep. Like, he's such a beast. He reads, I don't know, 20 books a day.
He reads in his sleep.
And half of them are not. Yeah, that's probably how he does it, you know?
Just like
microphone on the nightstand and just fall asleep slowly.
Yeah, you just get the mic stand, pulls it right up and just puts it in front of his face, wakes up in the morning, you're like, all right, what'd I get tonight?
He has to edit out a snore here and there, but it works. It works.
Probably, because this is like the 20th time or something that I've been having to pick up my jaw from the floor from such awesome help and from how awesome the community has been, I can't believe it. I've seen him do so many other things these last couple of weeks, and I thought I better cut him some slack and not pressure him too much about the book. And then he sends me a sound clip of the last sentence. So he's done with it, and I'm like,
such toxic bastards, right?
In the business. Yeah. We're so mean to each other all the time. Yeah.
So before we get back into the book, I got a little sidetrack to take. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Gigi. Go ahead. I'll take my little side cave here in a minute.
I was just going to say that I was really surprised by the foreword. I started reading it and I thought Knut wrote it, and in the end I saw that Hodlonaut wrote it, and I thought it was really well written and spot on. Like, I really love the idea of trying to incorporate an idea that is as big as Bitcoin is. You kind of have to change your framework of the world and change yourself. And it resonated strongly with me. And I just wanted to give a huge shout out to Hodlonaut. It's very well said, and is something that is very, very dear to my heart. As I also wrote in 21 Lessons, like, Bitcoin changes you more than you will ever change it. And I think that's a very important thing.
Yeah. The first sentence didn't give him away then, being a space cat.
Yeah, I know. Like, I just thought, you know, like, we're all huddling out, so.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a play in that. it made a lot of sense in hindsight, yeah.
Yeah, I'm so happy that I had this in me, because it just sort of, I hadn't written about Bitcoin for a while, and then on vacation in Spain, it just flooded out of me. So I'm happy I wrote it, and happy about everything surrounding it. Where were we? Do you want me to get into the details of the book?
Let's go for it.
Let's pretend like I haven't read it.
Okay.
Not yet.
as Brady said, it's a follow-up to Sovereignty Through Mathematics, which is like my first attempt at writing a proper Bitcoin book. And so I wrote another one, which is more of the same, I guess. But I could say it's deeper down the rabbit hole, but not maybe not the usual rabbit hole, because this is more of a philosophical angle on the entire thing, I think. And I start by the first chapter is called Fiction and Reality, where I differentiate between physical reality, like physical stuff, subjective reality, which is what we all experience in our daily lives, and intersubjective reality, which is which are all ideas that we collectively believe in, and that spans a lot of things. Like it used to be religions, and now it's nation states, and ultimately also money, which we need to believe in collectively in order for it to work. And I focus on how Bitcoin differs from every other type of money that preceded it, or every other type of intersubjective collective imaginative thing that's orders us, or like that's organizes us in a society. And
if I may, yeah. I'd like to chime in on that, because I think it's a really useful framework to think about things. And I mean, I try to not talk about Bitcoin all the time in real life with my real life friends and family, but I sometimes do. And when it comes up, often I hear the phrase very often that, well, but I do believe in Bitcoin, or I don't believe in Bitcoin. And we're still at the stage where people are trying to decide for themselves if this is something real or not. And when was the last time that you heard that, well, I don't really believe in gold, so that's why I'm not buying it, you know? Or I believe in gold, and that's why I invested in it, or something like that. I think it's really interesting that some things are just so taken for granted that you're beyond the belief stage. And I think, you know, like as Bitcoiners, we're just ahead of the curve. For us, Bitcoin is a real thing, and it won't go away, and we believe very strongly in it. Like
exactly.
You know,
it's like we say,
society believes very strongly in gold. <for
example. laughs> It's like we like to say that everyone is a Bitcoiner, they just don't know it yet, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly. I see the two books that you have behind you there, Gigi. And both of those books were a huge influence on me writing this one, especially Human Action, but also The Sovereign Individual, which is another book that I'm halfway through. but I really like that as well. But Human Action only took 38 hours to listen to something. It's really dense, but it's a well worth read, I believe. Everyone should read Human Action.
That's why I try to shill them subconsciously all the time, and I think they're really important to on your journey as a Bitcoin. I think they're very important, and I believe that we're currently living through the societal shift that is outlined in The Sovereign Individual. And I think to really understand everything that's going on right now, you kind of need the praxeological framework laid out in Human Action by Mises. And if you don't understand it, you're just confused and you're having a very hard time, and you just think that the world has gone completely crazy, which is kind of true. But I think the frameworks laid out in those two books really help you in the transition that we are currently living through. And I think especially The Sovereign Individual is something that everyone who's struggling with the current reality should read, because I also believe that the change we're living through right now, I think it will still accelerate. I think the change that is laid out in The Sovereign Individual, it can happen rather quickly, even more quickly than most Bitcoiners realize. And I'm a huge believer in like exponential change. And I think that, you know, everything is so primed right now, also with the macroeconomic landscape and the political landscape, that it doesn't need much for all the dominoes to fall at once, so to speak. So
just a little push.
Interesting times, that's for sure.
Yeah, agree totally. And I believe hyper Bitcoinization is a scenario that will be even faster than hyperinflation is, and like it's this, it's like hyperinflation in reverse. And I think it will play out even faster because of an even more limited, like Bitcoins are scarce and there are 7 billion people, and as the amount of money in the world is just vast, so yeah, exactly. It can happen really fast.
Yeah, I think the two processes, they're kind of in an eternal feedback loop until hyperbitcoinization is complete, as other currencies inflate and other assets inflate, and hyperbitcoinization or bitcoinization first takes place. It will accelerate, like the two processes will accelerate each other. I think it's like two sides of the same coin, pretty much. What I wanted to point out at the very beginning, where Brady said that Swan will always be a Bitcoin only company, and I was thinking about, you know, once hyperbitcoinization is complete, Swan will be obsolete. So you'll have to pivot at some point. You'll have to pivot to some circular Bitcoin economy model at some point in time when there's nothing yet left.
There won't be Bitcoin companies and non-Bitcoin companies. They'll just be companies.
Exactly. Just be companies. Yeah. And that, you know, mission accomplished. You know, I hope that we obsolete ourselves in that regard, and I'm sure we'll come up with other ways to serve Bitcoiners, or, you know, people. I guess we should put it.
It won't be Bitcoiners and non-Bitcoiners. It'll just be just be people.
Money users.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
Sorry, Knud.
No, go on.
Speaking of hyperbitcoinization, I'm just amazed. Like I was hyper bullish before. Like I've been telling people for the last 2 years at least that everything will happen faster than most people can imagine. But even I'm surprised all the time. And it seems like we have so many Bitcoin accelerationists disguised as politicians, you know, just passing out stimulus checks left and right and introducing debit cards and just sending money to everyone. And like it doesn't matter what part of the world you're in currently, just the money printers go wild and
they go brr.
Yeah, exactly. And people are, I feel like that even like complete normies that never thought about money or the economy or Bitcoin or any related topics, they're starting to take notice as well. And I think once trust in the current system is broken, it won't take much for everything to accelerate massively. The only worry I have is that we will have another insane misallocation of resources and time, because I think there will be another shitcoin phase. I think, you know, a lot of people will fall for the same traps as they did in 2017, and it will be a bumpy road, that's for sure, but I think it can happen rather quickly.
I'm a little hopeful though. Like I mean how do we talk about this? Basically, like, everyone's talking about the stock to flow model on one side, and this sounds like it's a tangent, but just go with me for a second. So there's the stock to flow of Bitcoin, but no one's talking about the stock to flow of like good Bitcoin knowledge. And I think we're seeing a ramp up in how much good Bitcoin knowledge there is and how easy it is to learn about Bitcoin compared to the early days. And I think that might help accelerate things also in a different way. Like, yes, I think there's going to be tons of shitcoin scams as the price goes up, because that's just what happens. But I don't know. There's an optimist hiding inside me somewhere.
I just wrote an article for... sorry, did I interrupt you, Breaking?
No, no, no.
I just wrote an article for Citadel 21, which is Hodlonaut's magazine. That maybe I'm spoiling the thing here, but that's not my intention. But I had a thought, and what if this next bull run is hyperbitcoinization? What if this is where everything transitions into Bitcoin? Because I think we're all prepared for another wave of shitcoinery, and another like it will do what it has done like three or four times now. There will be a bull run, and then we will drop 80%, and people will say it was bull crap and a bubble and whatever. But what if the next run that starts whenever we cross 10K or whatever it is, whatever triggers it, it's like oozing right now, isn't it? Like it's in the air, it's just about to happen, and the mother of all bubbles is about to pop. And when it does, if this is hyper bitcoinization, and as GD says, if it plays out out a lot faster than we were prepared for. Who's prepared for that? I mean, are we? What if Bitcoin is one single Bitcoin is worth $10 million in 2 months' time from now? It is a possible scenario. It could happen.
I'll have to get a second 3D printer and start printing guns. Like, seriously, that's what I would have to.
Yeah, probably.
Well, Swan Signal Live will be over. We'll all go dark. No, we'll still be here.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it will happen like magically quickly. But just think back to some other things in terms of, you know, like just the computing revolution and the internet and mobile phones, obviously, and also other phenomena. Just look at Zoom, for example. You know, like 2 years ago, Zoom wasn't a thing, except you were in some corporation that might use it. And now Zoom is pretty much the default and everywhere. Or think of TikTok or some other phenomenon. Things spread really, really quickly and happen really quickly. But we're talking about money here and the reallocation of wealth into another very misunderstood and very new asset. And I think the rails are just being built. And I think it's also obvious that the base layer won't be used by normal people once hyper-Bitcoinization really starts, or once Bitcoinization really starts. I think that this is just obvious. I think everything has to go through Lightning and other scaling solutions, because as Saifedean lays out beautifully as well, it's basically mostly a settlement system, not really a payment system. So yep. It will be used to settle between what we think now of banks or central banks or large settlement systems. And I think all of this will kind of take time. Like,
Never be ready though. I mean, like, that's kind of the way Bitcoin and technology works. Like, exactly. The wave of people will come, the tech will be overwhelmed slightly, then Bitcoin will catch up, and then more people, and then we'll catch up, and that's just how it goes. And we have to.
Yeah, I think the best metaphor for the internet was electricity, as Jeff Bezos pointed out. And I think the best metaphor for Bitcoin is the internet. And it was the same with the internet. Like, the internet is always running at capacity, you know?
Yeah.
Like, even though if you 10x the capacity of the internet by using fiber or something, then you'd have 4K streaming video for everyone. And it's at capacity again. It will be the same for Bitcoin, I think.
Anti-fragile systems grow through stress and difficulty.
We have another rabbit hole to dive into there with the, like you say, that institutions like banks and nations will own Bitcoin. But I know I'm onto this a lot. How does it work? Yeah, not at the moment. There will probably be solutions for shared ownership. I mean, we have multisig, but that's about it. And you can have a
multisig works really well, I would say, for a scenario like that. You can have, because you don't necessarily need like a 2 out of 3. You can have a 10 out of 15. And
there are 30 million out of 50 million.
No, but I just, I think, and we discussed this briefly before.
Yeah.
I think at the Value of Bitcoin conference.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are similar systems in politics and in the military that rely on also like not a single point of failure. And I think you have it in your new book as well with atomic launch codes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And but you can imagine something like that where you have, and just keep in mind that we already do have something like that for internet certificates, for example. There are signing ceremonies, there are key generation ceremonies, and there are a lot of people involved, and those are very well documented and very official processes. And you can imagine that either a large bank or even a political body carries out such ceremonies, and you end up with like 10 hardware wallets. Each of them has a key, and you have one or multiple multisig wallets, stuff like that.
Yeah, but still, I think it's sort of naturally these groups that actually control the assets, are forced to be smaller than institutions are right now. Institutions right now can have like a lot of people on top, and this is not possible in the same way with Bitcoin, I believe, since the information about the underlying asset is the underlying asset, and this turns everything on its head, because information itself is literally valuable. And I still have a hard time wrapping my head around what impact this will have on how we structure society, because it sort of turns ownership on its head. And the metaphor I've been thinking about trying to find a good metaphor for this, and the thing that pops into my head keeps popping into my head is that Monty Python sketch about the funniest joke in the world. Have you seen this? This is an old sketch that Monty Python did in the Flying Circus, where some guy writes the funniest joke in the world, and if you see the joke, you will die of laughter. So they try to militarize the joke by translating it into German in the war, and they can't see the entire joke. The translators can't be allowed to see the entire joke because then they will die from laughter themselves. So they have to see one word each. And on one occasion, a guy sees two words and he has to be in intensive care for 2 months and whatever. And they translate it into German. And in German, it's something like, maybe you should shut your ears now, Gigi, because you'll understand it. But the German translation is, Wenn ist das Nünstück, get und Schlottermeier? Ja. Bayerhunden ist ober der Flippewald gespurt. And they go on saying this phrase to German soldiers in the war, and they all die of laughter up and down. And I think this is a good metaphor for how I view the seed phrases of a multisig Bitcoin wallet used by nation states.
Just for the record, I didn't understand the word. Like,
no.
It's fake German. It's not even real.
It's just gibberish. Yeah. Anyway, there are actually some, the Germans try to write a counter joke, and the funniest thing they can come up with is, there were two peanuts walking down the Strasse, and then one was a salted peanut.
Yeah.
So it doesn't work very, very well for them. But
I can't tell if I'm laughing at the joke or at the attempt at a joke.
Yeah exactly. So, but anyway, this is sort of how I think about these things, because when information is literally valuable, you can very easily just leave the country with that information in your head and extort someone or like do something with it in order to monetize.
I understand your concern in principle, and I also understand what you mean, but I think you just lack a little bit of imagination of how creative governments can get by doing weird things. And I think they would just come up with a hardware wallet that will never display the seed phrase, and the only place where the private key lives is on the chip. And you can do it also in a kind of secure way and stuff. So you would like revert to the old world of physical things, where you have like two keys for the nuclear.
Yeah, I guess they can be very imaginative. But the guy knowing the seed phrase.
that's also my point. That doesn't necessarily have to be a guy who knows the seed phrase.
No. Well,
because the current hardware wallets, they have the courtesy of showing you the seed phrase so you can make a backup. But what if this functionality doesn't exist? You know, like there are ways around it. And if Bitcoin becomes valuable enough for governments to care, they will figure this out. Governments are very good at some things, you know, and making money and forcing people to pay the money, they're quite good at that. So.
Yeah, but I still think Bitcoin makes it a lot harder for them because they'll have to rethink everything, and they're so good at misallocating resources. So I'm not sure that they'll be able to catch up. It's like the cops trying to shut down the Pirate Bay for 25 years and not. I think the hacker lesson. The hackers will be 20 steps ahead at all times. As like governments aren't having these conversations now, we are. So.
Yeah. I agree with you in principle. I just think that these things will be figured out once they become relevant enough. Another scenario, like I'm still optimistic and hopeful, and I also like the idea that governments still don't really care, which gives the plebs a kind of a head start, which is really good. So you don't often have this kind of situation. But I think, you know, they will catch up in time. And I actually have a book recommendation for you, Knut. I'd be very interested of what you think about the book. It's called Code 2.0. I don't remember the author. I will send you a link. But it's about how society changed because of the internet and computer code, and also how the code changed because of political pressure and because of pressure from society. And just it's a good book. Yeah, just think how the internet changed over time. You know, the internet was this utopian idea. Everyone has a home server, and everything is completely decentralized, and freedom over everything, and it doesn't matter where you're from, it doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter what gender you have, everyone has a screen name and so on. And now we have Facebook and Google, and it very much matters where you're from, and it very much matters what your identity is, and people get deplatformed all the time, and the internet isn't what it used to be, and we have we don't really have net neutrality anymore. We have the Great Firewall of China. In Europe, we have so many laws that destroy the internet that it's not even funny anymore. I mean, there are laws against memes, for God's sakes.
Yeah, Gigi, how do you get away with it?
Again, how do you...
How do you get away with the memes? I've always been curious.
Yeah, you know, like 7 proxies and you know, it's not far behind. At least 7 proxies. Yeah. No, it's just, I think we should take the powers that are currently in charge seriously as well. Like, don't underestimate your enemy. And again, I say this all the time. We're still living in peacetime. Nobody gives a fuck about Bitcoin. It's still at this stage. Like, nation states and central banks, they don't give a fuck about Bitcoin. I mean, they're the first concerned voices in some corners of Congress, and some people... kind of, you know, want to stop it and want to, they know what might be coming, but I think they still don't take it really seriously. And I also think they don't take the exponential aspect of it seriously. But we're still living in peacetime, and once wartime starts, it will get really ugly. It will get really ugly, I think.
All right, let's go down this rabbit hole. And just a quick note before we do, the book Code 2.0 is written by Lawrence Lessig. And is a great one. I've read it as well. It's one that Bitcoiners should, I think, read, and we can and discuss. Love to have that conversation with you, Knut, and Gigi on Citizen Bitcoin, maybe. So let's dive down. What does this look like? What does the hyper Bitcoinization process look like? Let's do like the, you know, kind of the dark version, right? Like this wartime version that Gigi's talking about. What could we expect if it's a dark side? Let's not go like to the absolute extreme, but let's like be realistic about, you know, what challenges Bitcoiners can face. And let's do the other side too. Like what path can we see or imagine where the process of hyper Bitcoinization would be relatively peaceful?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as with all things, I don't think it will be pure utopia or pure dystopia. It will be something in between. I can talk about the dark things quite a bit, I think. But I think we're already living through it. And I think also what's interesting is everything is happening at the same time. I think people underestimate that also in terms of Bitcoin becoming money. Like Bitcoin for many people is a medium of exchange, a unit of account, and a store of value. And it's all at the same time. If you're a hodler, it's obviously a store of value. But there are many shops that only take Bitcoin, for example, and then you have to use it as a medium of exchange. There are some people that only take Bitcoin, and there's the pay me in Bitcoin movement. And there are also shitcoin traders. For them, Bitcoin is a unit of account. And everything is happening at the same time. And it's also in terms of protocol development, everything is happening at the same time. You know, like with Bitcoin, which is still being developed, with Lightning, which is still being developed, with third layer solutions that are being developed. So I don't see it as a nice and orderly process. I see it as everything is kind of happening at the same time. And I think it will continue to happen in this kind of parallel way. And I think hyper-Bitcoinization will continue to happen organically. Like there will be people that value Bitcoin more than fiat currency. And there will be more and more merchants that only accept Bitcoin or accept Bitcoin preferably. Like if you get a 20% discount or a 50% discount, if you pay with Bitcoin, more and more people will pay in Bitcoin. There will be more companies, there will be more investors coming into the space. And at one point, you know, I see it as a series of step functions that are exponential in nature, like a series of S-curves. And if you zoom out far enough, it will be one big S-curve, because at one point, fiat currencies cease to exist and there will be only Bitcoin left. Generally speaking, you know, I think there will be pockets on the internet and in the world where other currencies are in use. We see this now as well. You know, there are some communities that they make up their own currency and only use that. And there will still be some countries or islands that force you for a very long time to use government mandated currency. But I think it will happen organically and naturally, starting from individuals and small companies, bigger companies, then maybe small nations and small nation states. Once you're able to pay your taxes in Bitcoin, and once they tax you for things in Bitcoin, or you're paying your fees in Bitcoin or whatever, like you're,
or if you're a company and you want to pay your employees in Bitcoin, then you call us and then we
nice,
hook that up.
Yeah, nice chill. And I think it will be just a natural process. On the dark side of things, I think once governments start caring a lot about it, they might try to outlaw it, or they might start to prosecute Bitcoiners, companies that use Bitcoin. I mean, it's already kind of happening that if you're a Bitcoin company, you have to take care of so many things that a regular company doesn't have to take care of. I mean, I know it's different in every country, but in the US, for example, there are multiple agencies that think they have jurisdiction over your Bitcoin company. Like you guys probably know more about that than I do, but it's, on the one hand, it's an asset. On the other hand, it's you have to pay all kinds of taxes and capital gains taxes on it, and so on and so forth. So the dark side, I see it very much like it is with like it is on the internet as well. You know, like there will be efforts to undermine it. There will be efforts to just undermine the free nature and the structure of Bitcoin. Like if every transaction has to go through a centralized exchange, for example, by law, then this would be a huge blow to Bitcoin. If people start to more or less go after Bitcoiners, go after individuals and companies that use Bitcoin and advocate for Bitcoin, then you're in hell as well, because we see that with certain political opinions right now. If you have a certain political opinion on the internet and a mob or the establishment comes after you, you're done for. Like, you won't get a job anymore. You will be fired. You will be ostracized from society pretty much. And this can happen with Bitcoiners easily. Like, I think that's why it's important that we have both pseudonymous Bitcoiners and also high profile real name Bitcoiners, because we kind of need both, you know. Like, you can't ostracize everyone at the same time, and especially not if you're Jack Dorsey and Elon Musk and so on and so forth. So I don't know. I just think Bitcoin is still small enough that governments don't really care. And I think it can get kind of ugly if they start caring. I don't know. What do you guys think?
There are so many things here. First of all, even if we remove the whole notion of the that nation states will have a problem holding Bitcoin, I think the concept of the nation state will be harder to uphold in a Bitcoin dominated world, because like you say, taxes paid in Bitcoin. How are you to tax people if in the future we transition to something more anonymous, like the hi Corey, the Lightning Network or other scaling solutions, for instance, and we manage to make them much more private, so that you can actually do things on a so-called black market. There will be no way for governments to keep up and to tax people as they do now, and like the only response they have is more of the same. And the same goes for, you say you see a giant S-curve, smaller S-curves becoming a giant S-curve. The thing is, I don't really see the phase where the S sort of levels out, because if hyper-Bitcoinization is to happen, the only defense the government has is to print more money and hope that people will still fall for it. So I just see...
It depends on the Y-axis. Because if you choose a dollar value, then I agree with you. But if you just choose purchasing power and value in general, then
yeah. But even that, like, of course, we can't have exponential growth forever. But a sound money free market system makes everything work so much better, and everyone becomes so much more productive, and resources are allocated in much better ways. So the value of a single minute of work, a single minute of work for a productive person is getting more and more valuable by the day. In such a world, so I don't really see an end to where the S curve levels out, or it might take a long time. It might take hundreds or even thousands of years before it levels out. So I think a hyper-Bitcoinization scenario is. Like you say, it's hard to imagine how fast it can be, but it's also hard to imagine the magnitude and what it will do to us all and to society at large, because it sort of turns everything on its head when everyone holds a fraction of a Bitcoin is a billionaire in the span of a couple of months. I mean. What happens then when you can buy not only friends but armies, and when you can buy not only another house but you can buy a citadel or a couple of citadels, so you can buy small cities, and that, like, yeah. I mean, there's no limit to it. It is hard to imagine.
Keep,
but
keep talking about this. Our viewership is rising. Just keep going.
Yeah, is everyone turning bullish now?
I mean, I do think the speed with which it happens obviously matters, right? Because if it happens really quickly, then there's an escape velocity that even governments can't keep up with, because the popular demand for the money will exceed any ability for a lumbering government to try to stop. And I agree, we have to all be concerned about potential attacks against Bitcoiners, individual Bitcoiners, and that's likely going to happen. We've seen it with Ross, and when that comes around again. But and it will be a terrible tragedy, but at the same time, the stronger the community is, the more robust it is, those kinds of actions will just make Bitcoin stronger, make more demand for it, rally the crew, to the cause, right? The light side. So I think the speed of it, if it happens really quickly, I think is hopeful. The other thing that gives me hope is seeing adoption by politicians in relatively free Western countries, for instance, right? That have some semblance of democracy and representative governments. We've already seen this, happen in the United States. And if more and more of these representatives are holding Bitcoin and advocating for Bitcoin within our rule of law, then I think that's very positive as well.
Yeah, but let me just jump in there for a second, because if governors and senators start owning Bitcoin privately first, and then try to implement the policies for the government to accumulate Bitcoin, then they will be ahead of that curve too. So when as the price rises, and they got in earlier, they will be richer than the country they represent, or the state they represent, or the city they represent. So you have a shift. You have an enormous shift in the power structures that be, because the individuals become more important than the institutions at a very fast pace. And like Gigi says, I'm also concerned, because I think a transition might be violent and dangerous and not very pleasant to live through.
I mean, just to look back to some things you said, Knut, in terms of taxation and how governments would do that, I think, again, with a little bit of imagination, I can tell you how they might do that, and I even have some examples. For example, in Austria, where I'm from, the church is an organization that by default you pay taxes for. So by default, you have a certain percentage of your income go to the church, and if you're not willing to tell them how much you earn, they have ways of finding out. And if they if they are unable to find it out, they will just guess, and you will have to pay that. So based on your tweets, I can guess how much Bitcoin you might have if I'm an evil government, and you will be required by law to pay that.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I'm at risk now. My OPSEC is terrible, and I'm at risk, and I'm aware of it. And it's not only the mafia that runs the government here. It's the Russian mafia and whatever. We're all exposed to. I mean, obviously not you, Gigi. You're taking so much precautions, but everyone else.
But what people don't realize is Gigi is actually a very high-ranking politician. Also, he's both an anon and a public face. Yeah. Yeah. He's Angela Merkel, actually.
He's Batman.
Wouldn't that be awesome? And the second thing I wanted to loop back to is, while I agree that it can happen rather quickly and quicker than most expect, I'm just saying that because many Bitcoiners will tell you time frames of like 50 years, something like that. Just remember that the iPhone is like 12 years old or something, you know, pretty much like 10 years, like let's say smartphones are like 10 years old. So it's insane how quickly things happen in this world.
There's a chapter about this in the book as well.
And I really like the recent work of Plan B with his stock to flow cross asset model, where he talks about the phases that we currently went through. And he talks about these phase transitions. And I very much agree with this kind of model that it first was like a proof of concept, like no value at all. And then I think the most important transition for Bitcoin was from no value at all to some value, because now we are in this insane feedback loop that is still going on and will just continue to go on forever, I think. And then who knows what the next phases will be, but I think it will come in phases. And I think it will, it will continue to coincide with the halvings, and it seems that Bitcoin is cyclical in that kind of sense. And who knows what the dollar value will be of these phases, because first of all, the dollar is devaluing like crazy and will continue to do so, because the only real government response that is currently en vogue is just printing more money, no matter what kind of problem governments run into. And so it's really hard to talk about the dollar value. It's also really hard to imagine where the price might go, because Bitcoin is like the only thing that can move in Bitcoin is the price. And 2017 was just individual people FOMOing into Bitcoin. It was your neighbor FOMOing into Bitcoin. It was just regular, ordinary people. It wasn't investors, it wasn't even like large pools of money, and it definitely wasn't governments. And at one of those phases, maybe it is this phase already, or maybe it will be the one after that, or maybe the one after that. At one point in time, nation states might see the value of that and see also the tactical importance and potential of an asset like Bitcoin, and they will start FOMOing into Bitcoin, just like individuals started foaming into Bitcoin in 2017. Of course, they might be smarter about it and so on, but I think it's really hard to tell where the upper limit of those kind of processes is, but I don't think it will happen overnight. I think it will happen in those stepwise phases.
Hold on one second, Knut. Sorry. I wanted to welcome Corey, founder of Swan.
Oh, yeah.
Real quick. And it looks like Corey has something to say, and then Knut can take it.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to pull in something that we talked about with Bitcoin Tina last week, which I thought summed it up nicely. It was basically we got to 20K with poor millennials chipping in. and this cycle is going to be like, you know, rich Gen X people and Paul Tudor Jones and, you know, fund managers and things like that. Ship. And that's kind of what we're seeing.
Also, I just wanted to say, if any nation states are watching and you'd like to set up an account with Swan, we're more than happy to help you onboard. Your monetary base, we can help you with that. So
yeah, and read up first.
it's amazing how many of these governments that are likely candidates have been heavily consulted already on Bitcoin. Like, they know what it is. I'm thinking, like, in particular, obviously China knows more about Bitcoin than probably any of us do collectively. Turkey, I mean, they've had people in there with Erdogan and AKP for five, six, 7 years now. Like, they understand exactly what it is, and they're thinking about it strategically. And, you know, I think Putin, clearly we've seen, you know, that guy's understood Bitcoin for quite some time. So I don't know. I don't think it's ignorance. I mean, I know for sure that there's at least one person, I don't know how many others, but at least one person that's been to the Trump White House 3 times to talk to Trump and team about Bitcoin in the last, you know, 3 years. So I don't think there's ignorance at these levels. I think it just maybe isn't a strategic priority because it's still such a small asset class.
It'll be interesting to think about how, like, there's this massive wealth redistribution that will happen, but, like, it will happen with nations, too, like you're talking about. Like, even, like, I don't know, in 50 years, 100 years, like, which will be the more developed nations, you know, the ones that decided to go all in on Bitcoin? Like, the landscape will just be completely different, I think.
But yeah, but let me just turn this on, try to turn this on its head, because you say when nation states start FOMOing out and stuff like that. But what is a nation? What is its smallest part? What is it made up of? It's made up of people. And mm-hmm. the people that are advising Trump or whatever, or Trump himself, or Erdogan, or Erdogan's crew, Putin's posse, all these people, they will start FOMOing individually before the nation state starts FOMOing.
So my point
is this is a revolution on the individual level first, before institutions can even. Like, the people that get to know about it and buy into the whole idea, they secure their own backyard first before they even start thinking about talking to these guys.
My point is, this well, that's the hope, though, you know? Like, I would hope that we, as Bitcoiners, are promoting Bitcoin and getting the word out, and people are learning and realizing that they have this power to do something for themselves now. Before the nation states start FOMOing in, because at that point it'll be much more difficult for individuals.
One thing also, Knut, is that you must not forget that nation states and everyone who has a money printer has an unfair advantage. You know,
like you
will have to work hard for your Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's my biggest concern here.
There are some entities that can kind of play the system a little bit, play unfair games and get an advantage on that side. Because if you have access to a large pool of money, like taxpayer money, or if you just outright are printing money, you can just start the printers, not tell anyone, and just buy Bitcoin. And that's kind of unfair, but I think that's the reality we will see. The more corrupt the government, the more likely we're going to see that.
The counter argument to that is, why would you if you're the guy who sits on the printer? Because it obsoletes the printer, so
yeah. Well, but you might want to play a longer game.
Yeah, know? yeah. Of course.
I don't know.
There's a point to that.
I'm not an expert in those kind of areas, but I'm just thinking out loud and speculating of what might happen. You know, if I would have a money printer, I would print like crazy and just buy Bitcoin until my GG currency is worthless. That's what I would do the next 10 years.
The money printer is only valuable as a tool of burr, you know, while the populace believes that the funny money is real. You know, if the populace suddenly is like, this is bullshit, then, you know, at that point, the money printer is going to go burr as fast as they can to get as much Bitcoin as they could, you know, before it's too late.
It can take a long time, though. I mean, people still get paid in bolivars in Venezuela.
Yeah,
they still
sure.
Like it's worth literally worth less than toilet paper, but they still use it. I mean
people use whatever works best for them. Nobody really thinks about money or knows what it is, and people just use whatever brings food on the table that day. And if you're in really dire circumstances, a lot of different things might be used as money, even though it's really shitty. So
this ties into why I think we might be thinking of this organism, Bitcoin, in the wrong terms. Maybe it's not money. Maybe it's something else. Maybe we're wrong to be calling it money in the first place. Because, I mean, anything can be used as a medium of exchange, and it's the most saleable good that that will be used as a money in a certain jurisdiction. Yeah, and maybe Bitcoin isn't this thing. Maybe it's another thing altogether. And maybe we're confusing it with money because it was marketed as a money in the first place. But
I think you're onto something. I think that assessment is right. I think it's easiest right now to think of Bitcoin as money and as the best money we ever had. But just as email isn't just a better way to send a letter and the internet isn't just a better library.
Exactly.
Bitcoin isn't just, it isn't just a better money. And I think we see that already with kind of other services being built on top of it. Just think about tweet stamping, for example, you know? And also Bitcoin as a universal time. I really loved the last halving we had because it really felt like a global New Year's Eve. Everything was happening at the same time. No matter where you are, you're just now the block is here and, you know, happy halving everyone. So it definitely is a little bit more than money and it is a little bit different. So I really, really like that. But it's also what you said about sellability and liquidity and the moneyness of different things, I think is also accurate. And I think Andy Edstrom wrote about it very beautifully in his book.
Yeah, his 14 points. Yeah,
that everything has a kind of a moneyness. Just some things have a lot of moneyness and are really good money and are thus naturally used by people as money. And I think just to look back to Venezuela, there you're kind of forced to use whatever the shop around the corner is accepting. And that's currently worthless Bolivaris and also US dollar. And not yet Bitcoin for obvious reasons. I think Bitcoin is still kind of hard to use and you kind of, it's still very alien and hard to set up, hard to use. It's very easy to shoot yourself into the foot. But I'm very optimistic that this will be different in a couple of years. Like it's the same story always with technology, you know, like the first cars, they basically just killed yourself and they were very slow to boot. Like they killed you. that's what it was. Same with electricity and also with, you know, try sending an email in the 80s. It was just hell. And I think we're at that stage right now and everything is happening so fast that it gets easier by the month pretty much. And once we have more abstraction layers and just everything embedded in very easy to use apps that are available on very cheap smartphones, then we will see the corner store in Venezuela use Bitcoin and Lightning as well. I'm quite convinced of that.
When we're on to Venezuela, I have to tell you about an article I wrote that like 3 years back called We're All Venezuelans. And I got a message from a Venezuelan refugee that had actually fled the country with a Bitcoin wallet and managed to store his wealth and get out of the country and save his family that way. And that story was just, I mean, I got goosebumps from it, of course. And he had read my article and agreed with it. The point of the article was that we're all on the same path. Hyperinflation will happen everywhere, just at different speeds.
So
we're no different. The dollar is no different to the Bolivar. It's just the speed of the brr. that makes them different, and Bitcoin is an entirely different piece. But hearing these stories and like connecting with these people makes it all worthwhile for me. While being a creative entity in this space, like I really enjoy reading stuff like that. Of course, when connecting with people in that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. I have a question that I think would be a nice way to sort of finish up this conversation. We have another 15 or 20 minutes left. Phil Gibbs in the Swan Signal chat room on Telegram. You can join us there at t.me/swansignal. He asks, what are the top most important lessons you've learned from Bitcoin? So let's go with like, you know, top two or three most important lessons you've learned from Bitcoin. Gigi, I know it's going to be hard for you because you've got 21 of them to pick from. Let's start with you though.
The most important one, I think. Yeah, I think still lesson one is the most important one for me. And I'll expand on that a little bit. Like the first lesson in my book is that you can't change Bitcoin, but Bitcoin will change you. And I think it's important for multiple reasons. Bitcoin is still extremely difficult to understand, and most people have an insane amount of trouble wrapping their head around it. And once everyone has a different moment where they kind of get it. Some people are primed more in different directions. You might have studied Austrian economics before you got into Bitcoin. You might have studied distributed systems before you got into Bitcoin. If you did so, then you're obviously primed. If not, you kind of have to get a certain level of understanding that you kind of can trust this system. You don't take anyone's word for it. It's just when people say that Bitcoin can't go down, or like if, as Ralph Merkel said, if a nuclear war destroyed half of the planet, Bitcoin will march on and it can't be manipulated and can't be argued with. If you hear that first, there you kind of, there's no way that you can believe that. You have to get to a certain level until it really clicks and you understand it. And I think a lot of people, they fall into the trap of just not believing it and are just repelled by Bitcoin. And I think another reason why this lesson is so important to me is that if you don't incorporate Bitcoin into your worldview, it can be very difficult for you psychologically as well. And I think that's even true if you have been in the Bitcoin space for quite a long time. And I think we saw that during the Civil War. I think a lot of people suffered Bitcoin derangement syndrome, and I think it's a very real thing. Once you try to fight this organism, you almost won't come out alive, you know, like the community will eat you up, and even like your own thoughts will eat you up. And I think that's the most important lesson, that, it will change you more than you will change it. And to follow up on that, you kind of have to live in symbiosis with this weird organism. Fighting it is not the best strategy. And that's for me, like by far the most important lesson.
All right.
Awesome.
you want me to follow from there?
Yes, please. Let's hear it.
Yeah. Three important lessons. First of all, it taught me that I'm not alone having this worldview that I have, this way of looking at things. There are many people like me out there, and Bitcoin sort of. We come from very different backgrounds, all of us Bitcoiners, but we have a mindset in common that I didn't think I'd find a community like this before Bitcoin. And secondly, a sad insight that it has given me is the amount of insincerity out there in the world. And I've mostly learned this from all the fake Bitcoiners and the shitcoiners and the fork guys and the you know who I'm talking about. And there are so many of them, and so many people that fall for buzzwords and just join whatever thing is trending at the moment. And the sheer amount of insincerity in the world is really depressing. And the third lesson, I had something in mind, but
you depressed yourself there.
Yes, yeah, sort of.
Don't worry, we have Bitcoin. It's all right.
Yeah, it taught me to be less afraid. This is the point, that there are other ways to change society than political ways, and inventions are more important than political decisions, and they can change a lot more than you think. There are ways of don't waste your time trying to change the world by politics. Just change your own behavior and change your own narrative. That will have a larger impact on your life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the Hayek quote. I love that Hayek quote. You know, the one about, hold on, where is it? I don't believe we shall ever have a good money again before we take the thing out of the hands of the government. That is, we can't take them violently out of the hands of government. All we can do is by some sly roundabout way, introduce something that they can't stop.
Exactly.
And I think we can just keep, like when you were talking about this, I was basically thinking about how how greedy the world is. And the problem isn't that the world is greedy, it's that people try to fight that. They try to impose these morals on people and institutions or whatever, and that's fine. But like, greed is okay. It's as long as we have systems like Bitcoin that leverage it in the right way.
That's a gecko quote.
Greed is good.
It is good. Yeah.
But also, well, maybe we're going off on another crazy tangent here. But I went through a phase where I was really depressed because I just thought the world was super materialistic and everyone was greedy, and I didn't see a light at the end of the tunnel. And I think it was a Dalai Lama quote or something. But I was basically reading that how what we think of as greed is not actually greed. It's this materialism and how do I explain it? Basically, if you are being greedy, truly greedy, and trying to do something for yourself, we often think that we're doing something for ourselves, but really it's a deleterious action. It's something that's actually harming ourselves. And so by doing something for society, for others, you're actually doing for yourself. I don't know. I just went off on a crazy tangent.
if one thing, Bitcoin has made me less greedy, I think. I try to think of it this. And less greedy, I mean, taking more care of your financial life is greedy in a sense, but in another sense, like I want to give my family and my kids a better life, and my grandkids as well. And if that is greed, I agree, greed is good, but I don't really think it could be described as greed. It's something else.
If we define greed as short time preference, right? Then that, I think that makes real, you know, absolute sense. And then long time preference is more like greed. seven generational, you know, thinking. We're not just thinking about ourselves, we're thinking about the future and about, you know, humans that don't even exist yet that will come down the line. I think is a great way to look at it. And for me, that's the lesson that Bitcoin has taught me that's most important, is just that, you know, what money really is. You know, that money is such a pervasive, you know, yet subtle force in our lives and in our society, and that it affects us not only individually, obviously, but collectively as a society. And you build individuals and you build societies that are short time preference, and you get this materialistic sort of culture that you're talking about, Brecky. And then if you have a long time preference, you know, individually and socially as a society, then you build this, you know, kind of a more sustainable world, right? That's seven generational thinking, like that, you know, American Indian, Native American tribes would espouse. And like, I just think that's, you know, to me, instinctively seems like a better way to live.
Absolutely. And if I may add something to that, because both Knut depressed himself and Brecky said that he was kind of depressed about the state of the world as well. For me, it's not really a lesson, but what really made, like, Bitcoin made me really optimistic. And I know I'm not the only one who thinks that. Like, I was very nihilistic and depressed with the state of the world as well. And it's not only that, but even before I got into Bitcoin, I have a quote on my desk for the longest time by Aaron Swartz, may he rest in peace. And the quote says, it's something that he asks himself every day. And he said, "You literally ought to be asking yourself all the time, what is the most important thing in the world I could be working on right now? And if you are not working on that, why aren't you?" And for me, that is definitely Bitcoin. I had no good answer to that question before I found Bitcoin. And once it really clicked for me, it was obvious that I kind of have to give my life to that cause. And I really see it as a cause, as the separation of money and state. And I think good things will come of it. And of course, you know, there are awesome people working on it. And it's just an immense well of intellectual curiosity. I can't think of a better project to work on.
I agree totally. And like, for the first time in our lives, the light at the end of the tunnel might not be an oncoming train. And this is
the light at the end of the tunnel is orange. That's what I'm telling you.
Yeah, exactly. And it's lightning fast, and all of these things. And if you're like that, that's another great quote. If you're a libertarian and not into Bitcoin, what are you doing? Like, this is it. This is what you should be focusing on. If you dislike government and big governments and interventionism, this is it. stop doing whatever you're doing. Do this.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. Corey, do you have any thoughts to weigh in on this?
Yeah, this was just making me think a little bit about, you know, the Peter Thiel matrix that he put in 0 to 1, and just thinking about how few of us probably lived our lives in the definite optimist quadrant, where you have like a real view on where things are going and you feel positively about that. You know, and he breaks it down, and a lot of people have kind of looked at different cultures and different people and personality types, and like, you know, the Chinese generally as a culture have been definitely pessimistic, and the Americans up in, you know, up until probably 1971, let's say, were definitely optimistic, but have shifted, you know, very much toward being sort of naively optimistic, indefinitely optimistic. And now, you know, people around the world who are coming at life in the future through a nice orange lens on things are becoming definitely optimistic. I'm certainly living my life that way, and it sounds like you guys are too. The other thing that this discussion made me think of was, you know, Matt Ridley and The Rational Optimist, which is a great book if you read that one. And then also the newest book that I picked up, and I don't know why I didn't ever think to look at the guy's catalog and see what else he wrote, but John Carvalho recently recommended in a group The Red Queen, which was another Ridley book. So I just downloaded that and started listening to that. And I think that's really relevant to what you guys were talking about. Around greed and materialism. And basically the thought that came to mind for me was whether through nature or nurture or culture, whatever it is, whatever you see as most attractive in your mate, how you choose to live your life is going to be, and what your priorities are going to be, very determined by what is attractive to your desired mates. And so if you're in, you know, Portland or Brooklyn and, you know, being politically active and a social justice warrior, like, you know, we're fairly impressionable as humans, and you're probably going to go down that route and seek social status through doing, you know, what's perceived as good in your social circles so that you can, you know, find a mate basically. And if you're in a more, you know, materialistic culture, you know, most people again are fairly impressionable, and you're probably going to find yourself seeking material wealth and trying to get super rich and essentially being able to buy your way into a lifestyle that will attract the mate that you desire.
Yeah. Nice.
Anyway, but I haven't read the book yet. I hope that's what it says.
Have you all, random thought, have you all ever heard of Pascal's Wager?
Yeah. I have a lot of a section about this in the book.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I'd love to. Well, now I have to read your book.
Yeah. I debunk it. Because I think Pascal's Wager is one of the stupidest things in history. Because it only the wager is you might as well live your life as if there was a God. Otherwise, you might miss out on some.
But it's like no skin off your back if you believe, but if you don't, then you're missing out on a loss. I don't know. I was just kind of thinking of how it could be applied to Bitcoin, but it didn't really work.
No. I call it, this is another thought. It's not my original thoughts, but you know about Rocco's basilisk? Yes. Oh, okay. Well, let's start with Pascal's Wager then. Pascal's Wager says that you should follow the word of the Bible because there might be a God, and you might as well. But it doesn't take into account the other 5,000 gods that people believe in at this moment in time. So it's sort of pointless. Or like, you might as well live your life as a vegan because that is whatever. You can put whatever metric you want into the wager. It just takes one single theory into... So I think it's completely bullshit. And I think it's false logic and very easily debunked. Anyway, Rocco's basilisk is another idea that I find more fascinating, it's been called the most dangerous thought ever thunk. And it's basically an AI in the future that will punish everyone, go back in time and punish everyone that didn't bring it to life. so if you don't help this thing come alive, it will punish you after it does come alive.
Kind of like Bitcoin, you know?
Yes, yes. This is the point of the book. I call it Roko's Honey Badger instead, because it's the reverse of Roko's Basilisk. Because it will enrich everyone who helped it come alive, and it's like the corollary
to the basilisk. Yeah. The honey badger is the corollary.
Exactly. It's the positive basilisk. Nice. A basilisk that doesn't turn you into stone by staring you into the eyes, but turns you into gold.
Nice. Digital
or
gold.
Turns you orange anyway. Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of the thoughts like that in the book as well.
Awesome. All right. Well, I kind of feel like this is a good spot to kind of wrap up the conversation. Gigi and can you please take a moment to, you know, show us your links where people can find more about you and your books, etc. Gigi?
Yeah. Well, I'm DereGigi on Twitter and everywhere else. And you can find my writing on DereGigi.com. My book, 21 Lessons, you can find on Amazon, and on 21lessons.com. You can read it for free there as well. And it's also on Audible, thanks to Guy Swan. And I would like to shout out Mungo, the full-time philosopher. I have a romance with him going on Twitter all the time, and I just had to shout him out because I know he's listening. So Mungo, I hope this romance goes on. And yeah,
he's from Tallahassee.
Yeah.
Ass is asleep, thankfully.
I have a collection of photos now with 21 lessons and one or two of my books in the same photo, because people seem to be buying our, I don't know why, Gigi, but they seem to be buying our books together, to bundle them together. I have at least five of those photos. And I really like that, because I think they complement each other quite well. So... So I like that. And I thought I would mention this. Has anyone tried this? I just got this the other day. It's a Cabo Vault hardware wallet, which is air-gapped. So you scan QR codes and it's never connected to the internet. Did you hear about this thing?
Nice. I've heard
that's like a beautiful BitBoy.
Yeah. I think the good thing about it is everything, including the firmware, is open source as far as I know. So
Yeah. Exactly. And they have a Bitcoin-only firmware. They have a shitcoin firmware pre-installed, but you can easily switch to Bitcoin-only firmware if you're a real person. And I haven't really tried it out yet, so I don't really know that much about it. I just meddled a bit with it, and it looks nice, and the display looks nice, and it seems to be working. And you can find me. I'm Knut Swanholm everywhere. Sometimes I'm Knut.Swanholm.
Did you say Swanholm? You did, didn't you?
Swanholm. Yeah, Swanholm. We're chilling each other's name here. Yeah. You're not the only Swan Bitcoiner out there.
I like this. We gotta get Guy in here next time.
Yeah, we really do. And my first book is available for free as an audiobook on Guy's podcast, but it's also on Audible, and who reads it a bit better on Audible. And the both books are on Amazon, and they look like this. And I do most of my Bitcoin bullshittery on Twitter. So that's where you should follow me, if anywhere.
Excellent. Corey, you want to wrap up with anything, some updates on Swan, perhaps?
Sure. Yeah. So I think two quick things to announce. One is we have started doing a Get Paid in Bitcoin initiative. So we have some companies signing up to add, basically picking up the transaction fees for their employees on Swan. And we have a few companies already signed up in the beta. And we'll roll that out to everybody in June. But if you are a department boss or a CEO or someone who thinks that Bitcoin would be a really cool benefit and that some of your employees might enjoy that, or if you're an employee and you want to go and show Bitcoin to your boss or to your company ownership and tell them that this is a cool benefit, we think that is something that would be really appreciated. And you know, we're told by people who work in the benefits world that basically companies will offer a benefit if the perceived value of it is a lot higher than what it costs them. And there's nothing better than stacking sats and thinking about the 10x or 100x that it might be that can help people think that way. So that's the first thing. And then the second is we have rolled out SwanForce, which is basically our referral program. So you can go to swanbitcoin.com/enlist, E-N-L-I-S-T. And the cool thing about this is obviously we're US only for users, but the referral program is open to everyone globally, and we pay out in sats. And Jan is in my ear saying he wants to pay people out in Lightning so we can start contributing to that ecosystem. So we're really excited about the referral program. So go there, get your custom URL and landing page. So when people actually come to your URL, like swanbitcoin.com/newt or Gigi or whatever, there'll be a nice little picture of you and a message or a tweet or a quote from your book or whatever. So
hey, why don't we show them the Jan example real quick?
Yeah, or show them Kaiser actually. So Max Kaiser set this up last weekend.
FYI, I signed up already. So
there you go.
Ahead of
curve. We need to get you your little landing page welcome book, which is super cool.
Maybe /21 lessons, and there's a free download of 21 lessons on the same page.
Sounds good. Again, yep. Give this man a raise.
Rick, are you popping that up?
Oh, sorry. What is it? Just /Kaiser?
/Kaiser. K-E-I-S-E-R.
Swanbitcoin.com/K-E-I-S-E-R. It's a Kaiser. Boom. All right, give me a second.
Share screen. But yeah, in the meantime, guys, thank you so much for joining this. This was a really, really cool chat. I listened with rapt attention. There you go. So yeah, so that can be your face or your book and whatever quote you want it to say. And when anybody visits through your link, you'll be there shilling Bitcoin and helping at least those in the United States to sign up for Swan and start stacking sats significantly. Less expensive auto stacking than anyone else in the US. We're 60 to 75% cheaper than Coinbase, cheaper than Square by a long shot. I think we're 30 to 50% cheaper than Square at every level. That's Cash App. So yeah, sign up for Swan and help other people sign up for Swan and stack some sats.
Cool. Nice. I want to give a quick shout out to Bobo Dread, Phil Gibbs, Alice LaCrosse, Soft Simon, Nate Sharp, Daniel Prince, Max Kaiser. Thanks for joining us in the Swan Signal chat room today and hanging out. That's t.me/SwanSignal. We're there all the time, not just during broadcasts. So come hang out with us. We talk Bitcoin, whatever else. It's a lot of a really fun group. So that's it for today. Next week, I'll tease for those of you who stuck around for the entire episode. You deserve a little preview. Next week, we're excited.
Prime time.
And prime time, so it's going to be in the evening. I think. What time is it, Corey? 6 p.m.
Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern.
Okay. It'll be Preston Pish and Adam Back, Satoshi himself, joining us next week. I think it's going to be an awesome combo.
Why'd you move your coins, bro?
Exactly.
So that'll be fun. Make sure you tune in for next week. Subscribe to the podcast. You can listen later at swansignalpodcast.com. All right, that's it, everyone. Thanks again to Knut and Gigi. Go buy the books. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thanks for having us.
Thanks to Knut and Gigi for joining us. Follow Knut at Knut Svanholm. That's at KNUTSVANHOLM. And follow Gigi at DerGigi, DerGigi, on Twitter. On behalf of the entire Swan team, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed and found this episode useful. You can join us live next time. Find us on Twitter at Swan Bitcoin, or also find us on Facebook, Swan Bitcoin, Twitch, Swan Bitcoin, and on YouTube. It's the Swan Signal channel. You can also jump into our Swan Signal Telegram chat room. We have a lively crew in there. We're talking all hours of the day about Bitcoin and all kinds of other topics. Of course, we also talk during our actual broadcast, and you can ask questions of our guests. Find that chat at t.me/swansignal. That'll take you to the Telegram chat room. Swan Signal, of course, is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com, the best way to buy Bitcoin in the United States. We automatically withdraw dollars from your bank account. We automatically turn those dollars into Bitcoin, and then we automatically send them to your Bitcoin wallet if you set up an auto withdrawal. It's awesome, magical experience. We do this all at the lowest fees for recurring purchases in the industry. So find us on Twitter at SwanBitcoin. Subscribe to this podcast at swansignalpodcast.com if you are not already. And that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us.